It's a lie, Liza gasped. It's all a lie.
I must say, Skye said a little uncomfortably, it is most unfortunate that the Psi-Corps learned of Mr. Carter when they did. You might have escaped their attention and avoided all of this trauma otherwise. Liza's stare managed to grow wider, more glassy-eyed.
Haven't they told you?
She asked with a raw-edged, hysterical little giggle.
They?
Hutchins, Tanjo, that madwoman Dessler, haven't you spoken to them at all?
I didn't see them until this afternoon, Skye said, his tail twitching uncertainly. I was on the Freespacer city ship New Orleans all morning, and this afternoon has been quite busy. We spoke mostly of the things we saw today. You should really try to see the Denarius Belt before leaving this system. It is quite remarkable.
I called them, Liza husked, ignoring Skye's digression about the wonders of the Bajor system entirely.
I called the Psi-Corps. It was my responsibility, wasn't it?
A soft giggle emerged from the blankets which now wrapped Liza, clutched in trembling hands.
Protect them from themselves. Give the poor, confused telepaths a new home, a new life.
For a few moments, Skye's tail had gone utterly still. As he looked at Liza, however, his momentary rage faded, and he considered the small, pathetic-looking blonde girl wrapping herself for protection.
And in striking out at another, you struck yourself as well, he murmured.
Liza's eyes focused, looking at Skye's wedge-shaped head.
Stop pitying me, she said, clearly and firmly. You've never encountered true consequences before, have you?
Said Skye in a near whisper, almost as much to himself as to Liza.
This is the first time anything has ever rebounded directly back upon you, isn't it?
Get out! Liza rasped, her hands shaking as she stared at the Skrang.
And when you sought friendship, guidance, even basic love...
Skye shook his head.
You were rejected by that shallow, self-absorbed father of yours.
You have no right to speak of him like that, Liza said. Now get out!
You have every right in the world to do so, Skye said. You certainly do not have to grow up to be like him.
I said, get out! Liza pushed the covers aside and stood, slowly, from the bed, her hands trembling and clenching uncontrollably. One hand flew up to rub her temple. A second later it jerked back down, just a little too fast.
And now, Skye said sadly, you have not a friend on this station, and possibly not a friend in the entire galaxy.
I would change that, Elizabeth. We may never have been friends, but we were comrades before your short-sightedness drove me from your circle.
He reached down to his belt pouch and pulled out a small wooden object, a triangle of polished mahogany carved into a most intricate tangle.
I was given this on the New Orleans, he said, under most peculiar circumstances. I am told that it is a Jurian meditative charm. It is supposed to bring calm and stability to its wearer.
He took one of Liza's hands in his own and slowly pressed the wooden knot into it, wrapping her fingers around it.
Please keep it well. And when you need a friend, please think... Get out!
Liza hurled the charm across the room, where it bounced off the wall and fell soundlessly into the carpet.
Get out!
She held her head in her hands, tears running down her face, shrieking again and again at the top of her lungs.
Get out! Get out! Get out!
Skye slowly stepped backwards out of the room, not stopping until the automatic doors of the room had closed in front of his face. He stared for a long moment at the closed door of Red 1290's bedroom, straining his hearing for any sound from within. When not a sound met his earholes, his tail slumped, and with a potent sense of failure, Skye retraced his steps back to his own quarters, where awaited the sketching materials he had also acquired on the New Orleans. His muse called, insistently,
demanding he produce a series of sketches that, out of respect, he could never show anyone else. Ironic, he thought, that beauty can come from pain. Meanwhile, inside the room, Liza stood trembling in the middle of the room, pain shooting through her head, tears running down her face as she tried to regain her composure. With a wail, she threw herself back on the bed, grabbing a pillow and hugging it tight, crying loudly and uncontrollably into it. And as she cried, the words she couldn't say in front of anyone else came pouring out.
"I'm sorry, Daddy. Sky, Sky, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Caitlin. Utina, Amanda, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I'm sorry."
After a few minutes, she cried herself out. Feeling weak and hollow, she got up and found the charm Sky had given her. Mercifully, it hadn't been damaged by its collision with the wall. She sat down on the bed and gazed at it, running her fingertips over the intricate carvings. Calm and stability? Looking at it, Liza thought it better served as a physical representation of her inner turmoil. Sobbing again, more softly this time, she curled up on her side, holding the charm to her chest, and tried to go to sleep. Dinner aboard the Enterprise was a pleasant time. Captain Picard and his officers were good conversationalists, and quite nice people, really. Wakaba Shinohara found that surprising. All her encounters to date with members of Earth's armed forces hadn't gone very well, and she'd been given to understand that Starfleet was pretty much just an extension of Earth Force these days. Picard certainly didn't seem to think so, though. The man wasn't a soldier, not really. He was an explorer, a scientist. The fact that he commanded a battleship must have struck him as ironic, but he had too much grace to say so, at least in polite company. Wakaba found herself wishing she knew him well enough that he didn't consider her polite company. Oh, she wasn't drooling over him like Azalin. She liked older guys, but there were limits. He was interesting, though, and she would have liked to have known him better, the way Caitlin seemed to. Thinking of older guys, she glanced at Sayanji next to her. He'd seemed curiously preoccupied all evening. Not rude, but slightly distracted and pensive. She leaned over and murmured,
"Something the matter?"
"No," he replied. "Just something peculiar. Corwin's mother keeps looking at us. Mostly at you, I think."
"Really?
I hadn't noticed. Maybe she's just being friendly."
Sayanji shrugged.
"Perhaps," he replied. Then, in a more public tone of voice, he complimented the captain on the competence of his kitchen staff. Dessert came, then the hot beverage of one's choice, and Captain Picard gracefully wound the occasion up before people could start yawning.
"I've got something I'd like to announce before we adjourn," said Griffin, "if Captain Picard will permit me to monopolize his table for a moment." Smiling, Picard gestured openly.
"By all means, Captain Hutchins."
"Speech!"
cried Nall, which made Data glance curiously at him. Griffin walked behind Kate's chair, put his hands on her shoulders, and said, "As most of you know, Caitlin is my student in our family's art of swordsmanship, the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu. Yesterday, during the chase with the Psi-Corps, she manifested that art's greatest defensive technique, the Blade of the Inviolate Soul, which is proof that she's ready to take her place as a master of the art." Applause greeted this statement, making Kate blush. Griffin smiled, then held up a hand. "But," he said, "there's always a catch, right? There's one more thing she must do before that promotion is official. So, this Saturday at 1700 hours in the ship's dojo aboard Challenger, she'll face her test of advancement. Any of you who wish to attend will be most welcome. In fact, if you bring your equipment, you may even get a chance to help her take her place beside me."
"I'm sure she will bring great honor to your family name," intoned Lieutenant Worf with greater solemnity than the Klingon had probably intended.
"Indeed, Mr. Worf," said Picard.
He rose, adjusted his uniform jacket again, and smiled.
"Thank you all for coming. My officers and I wish you all the best of luck."
There were polite thank yous, and the duelists adjourned, filing out in ones and twos to follow Data to the Enterprise transporter room and return to B5. "Shame you won't be around for Kate's trial, Jean-Luc," said Griffin as the two captains walked toward the doors.
4 days, Picard responded with a thoughtful frown.
Then, his tone somewhat exaggeratedly brisk, he said, "I think it should take us about that long to verify Starfleet's charts of the Denorius Belt. Don't you, Number One?"
Riker didn't miss his cue. Smiling broadly, the first officer replied, "If we get right on it, yes, sir."
"As soon as our guests have disembarked, make it so. Arrange a return docking clearance with Commander Johnson for, shall we say, noon Saturday?"
"I think that would be just about right, sir," said Riker.
"I'll get right on it. Pleasure meeting you, Captain Hutchins."
"And you, Commander?" said Griffin. Riker peeled off down a side corridor, making for the nearest turbo lift, unable to quite conceal his chuckling.
"You're right, Jean-Luc. He does have a sense of humor," said Griffin appreciatively.
"I was under the impression," said Data with a puzzled expression, "that dragons were fearsome creatures of gigantic proportions." He stepped out of the turbo lift, then turned to hold the door for the group of students. Corwin came out and paused nearby so Nall could continue his conversation with the android.
"Oh, well, we are," Nall replied.
Data's look of puzzlement deepened. "Forgive me for saying so, but you do not seem to be gigantic, nor particularly fearsome."
"That's just because I'm hanging around with Rocket Boy here," Nall replied, nudging Corwin's cheek with his head. "If you found me in my mountain lair in Alfheim, well, that'd be a different story,"
the dragon added with an all-knowing nod.
"Ah," said Data, though the android did not look particularly enlightened.
"I was not aware that there was a draconian species living on Alfheim Colony."
"Figures there'd be a colony named after it," said Nall. He gathered himself up and jumped from Corwin's shoulder to Data's. "Listen, this is a long story. If you really want to hear it, great, but if I've got a transporter to catch, we're never going to finish in time. What do you say you guys take me with you on your sweep of the Denorius Belt, and when you're off duty, I'll tell you all about it."
Corwin arched an eyebrow, but said nothing. Nall was ditching him? Were the repairs to Dagger Disc that boring? But as Data replied that he would like that, if the captain allowed it, the little dragon turned his face back to Corwin, winked one scarlet eye, and sang to him in draconic, "There, now I'll be out of your hair for the next couple days." Corwin scowled.
"Damn it, Nall, you know it's..."
"Easy," said Nall, and his normally sarcastic mien was completely serious.
"I know, but still, that doesn't mean you need me around, huh? Trust me, you need some time without me hanging around. Least I can do after I was so insensitive yesterday."
Corwin looked back at the little dragon for a moment, then ruffled his head.
"Okay."
Then he switched back to standard. "Have a good time. I'll see you Saturday." Data looked curious, but was too polite to ask. Nall told him cheerily,
"Logistics."
"Ah," said Data. He tapped his communicator and set about securing permission for Nall to remain aboard as his guest during the Enterprise's Denorius survey. In the corridor outside Babylon 5's Green Sector transporter room, Amanda and Devlin bade farewell to the others. They didn't go into great detail as to why they were leaving. They didn't have to. Their friends could sense what came next, and though not all of them seemed to agree, nobody was stupid enough to think they could talk the Gamelon out of it.
"We will try to be back in time for your test, Caitlin," said Amanda. "If Dulshaya grants us good hunting..."
"Well..."
She smiled. "I would hate to miss it."
Kate nodded.
We'd miss you," she said, returning the smile, a little sadly, Amanda thought.
"Well..." Amanda squared up and nodded rather imperially at the group. "With luck, I'll see you all again soon."
Utrinna grinned, and then, to the surprise of several of those assembled, began to sing, if it can be called that, in Klingonese. Amanda looked momentarily puzzled, then amused, and she and Rena joined in on the second line. The guns are hot, the hull is ringing, the engines sing the sound of triumph, and everyone aboard awaits a prize upon the high horizon. Hand and weapon, heart and power, cry it with the voice of empire. Victory and prize and plunder, vengeance flies at morning.
I appreciate the sentiment, said Amanda when they'd finished. At the confused looks of several of the onlookers, she added with a smile, but I believe I'll leave you to explain it to the others.
On Wednesday morning, Edward Tversky and Ayn left the station. No one saw them leave, but they announced their departures in an email message which found its way to each of the XWPI students, as well as the station's management. They didn't specify which of the six ships that had left the Freespacer home fleet that morning they'd gone on, where they were headed, or when, or if, they were returning. All the message said was that Durandal needed to go on a little trip, and the two hackers were helping. Best wishes, love, and hugs were bestowed upon all. The duelists considered this for a few minutes, concluded that Edward would be Edward, and hoped the galaxy was ready for her. That same morning, Janice Barlow packed her few possessions and reported to Challenger for briefing by Captain Hutchins. Field agent training starts Monday at Experts HQ in New Avalon, Griffin told her, up in his office next to the ship's bridge. You'd best leave today if you want some time to settle into your new quarters in town before it starts. 4 weeks there, then a week of orientation at headquarters, and you'll be all set to head back here and take up your operational posting. We'll have an office ready for you on B5 by then. What do you say? Janice grinned. Sounds good to me. I always wanted to visit New Avalon. They went down to Shuttle Bay 2, where Janice was delighted to find that Griffin had done exactly what he'd threatened to do. Parked in the middle of the bay, smugly lording it over the ship's mere mortal warp shuttles, was a Danube-class runabout. It had been stripped of its Psi-Corps Enforcement Division markings and repainted in IPO Space Force colors, IPS Rubicon, NCC 3230, but it was undoubtedly the same one Janice had stolen from Earth a few days previous.
"This won't be trouble?" asked Janice as she stowed her duffel bag and the new cases she'd acquired for her frame and barista on the New Orleans.
Vision checked the records. The Corps wrote it off as presumed destroyed. Just to be safe, I had the transponder re-encoded and the isolinear ID tags changed. Nobody will ever know it's the same one unless they check the serial numbers engraved on the warp coils. He grinned. Give the technical section a week and those won't match either. I've arranged for her to be rebuilt to the new Kennebec spec while you're in training. Can't have you plodding around at warp 6 all the time.
Wow, and it's not even my birthday, said Janice.
Listen, not that I want to be a pain or anything, but what about school next year? Any word?
He smiled. I'm still chasing it, but it's starting to come together soon. By the time you get to New Avalon, there ought to be news.
Well, okay then. She looked momentarily at a loss. Then Griffin held out a hand.
Clear skies, Agent Barlow, he said.
Thanks, Chief, she replied with a grin, shaking the hand. Chuckling to himself, Griffin left the runabout in the shuttle bay, and Janice Barlow and her faithful Mag headed for New Avalon. After that, the next couple of days were largely uneventful. Most of the students kept to their rooms or gathered in small groups in one of B5's common areas, relaxing and catching up on their reading. By Thursday, they were starting to become a bit restless, wondering what was to become of them. Was the rest of the school year canceled? Would they have to take their finals here, or would the whole last term be written off? How would this affect their futures? And what were they going to do next year? They had assurances that Kate's father was looking into all this, and indeed, Challenger left the station on a mission to Earth early Thursday morning, but the lack of news was starting to put some of the students on edge. There were exceptions, of course. Caitlin hardly noticed, so busy was she in training and preparation for her upcoming mastery trial.
Jury spent much of her time observing Kate's practice sessions and serving as a dissimilar sparring partner. Utrina and Corwin continued the repairs to Dagger Disc. The others amused themselves however they could, waited, and wondered. Late Thursday night found Kyuichi Sayonji wandering the corridors of the station for lack of anything better to do. He was alone, and the not-yet-operational station's hallways were deserted and quiet, but that didn't bother Sayonji. He'd always been a bit of a lone wolf. In the old days, that had mainly been because his temperament had leaned toward brooding. Nowadays, well, he supposed he still had a tendency to brood, but not with the single-minded determination he'd once had. Eventually, his wanderings through the night-dimmed corridors of the station led him to one of the core shuttle stations. Of all the place's features, this had taken the most getting used to, for the train, since it ran along the rotating station's center line, was in a low-gravity zone. Not quite null gravity, but low, enough to make navigating around the train stations a novel experience for someone unused to variable gravity conditions. The trains themselves had gravity aboard, and negotiating the gradient was also a bit of a trick, rather like getting on an escalator. Sayonji was a fairly coordinated young man. In 3 days' wanderings, he'd pretty much mastered it. He stood, bouncing slightly on his heels in the weak gravity, and waited for a train, wondering if they ran 24 hours a day. It appeared they did, for in a few minutes one arrived. Sayonji climbed up the gravity gradient and boarded, bound for no particular destination. Perhaps he'd go look around Gray Sector. He had no reason to believe it was all that different from Red Sector, where Group B was quartered, or Green Sector, where those who had arrived on Dagger Disc were staying. But nevertheless, he realized as the train eased into motion again that he wasn't alone, and was further surprised to see that the other person in the shuttle car with him was Liza Broadbank. He found this interesting, since as far as anyone else in the WPI group knew, Liza hadn't left her room on Red 12 since her arrival on the station. She was sitting on the longitudinal bench which faced the doors in the middle of the train. She looked terrible. Her clothes, which looked like the same WPI uniform she'd been wearing when she was rescued from the Psi-Corps, were rumpled and dingy, and her curly blonde hair was a mess. Her face was oddly mottled, the pale skin reddened, especially around the eyes, which were sunken in dark rims. His curiosity piqued, Sayonji walked over and sat down on the first of the transverse seats, at right angles to Liza. She didn't seem to notice him. She merely sat, arms folded, gazing thoughtfully at the doors. They rode in silence through 3 stops, passing out of Green Sector into Blue. The core shuttle didn't reach very far into Blue Sector. The main docking corridor occupied the core in most of that sector. It paused at the last, or first, stop, then reversed direction and headed back toward the other end. They rode past the station where Sayonji had boarded, and still Liza didn't speak, didn't acknowledge his presence at all. Not until they entered the Arboretum, cruising slowly through the rather surreal world of its rolled-up square mile of countryside, did she speak. And even then, from her tone, she might merely have been thinking aloud. What she said was, "There has to be some way to open those doors." Sayonji looked at the doors, then back at Liza. "Why would you want to?" he inquired conversationally. Liza got up and walked slowly across the car to the doors. She put her hand against one of them and stood looking out of the window at the slowly turning ground below. "You know," she said, without turning to look at him, "there are a surprisingly small number of ways to die here, considering it's a space station. You can't operate the airlocks without security codes. Weapons are inaccessible. There aren't any exposed beams in the living quarters to hang oneself from." Sayonji grunted noncommittally. "Inconsiderate of them," he remarked. "Very," Liza replied, her tone lacking irony. "But if I could get these doors open." Sayonji got up and looked out the window as well. A flamboyant exit, but somewhat drawn out. Liza blinked, as if realizing for the first time she wasn't alone, and said, "What do you mean?" Sionji gave no indication whatsoever that the conversation he was having was anything but perfectly normal, as he replied, "There's artificial gravity aboard the train, but outside it's quite weak. Even if you pushed off as hard as you could, it would take, oh, I would say a minute at least, to reach the ground, which is turning at around 60 miles an hour, if I remember what Commander Ivanova told us on our tour. That's what would kill you, not the fall." He shook his head. "Not the way I'd choose to do it."
"What way would you choose?"
Sionji gave the impression that he was seriously considering the question, then replied, "I'm a Kendoka, a somewhat tarnished one, but a Kendoka still. If I were seeking my own end for some reason, I would transfix myself on my sword, then have a trusted second relieve me of my head." Liza gave a hollow, mirthless laugh. "No one I know would be willing to grant me the honor," she said. "Caitlin should have let the Corps take me. It's as much as I deserve." Sionji cocked an eyebrow. "Why did they want you?" he wondered. Liza turned disbelieving eyes to him. "You act as if you don't know."
"I don't."
"That's ridiculous. Surely the Skrang has shared it with everyone by now." Sionji shook his head.
"He refuses to say a thing about it. It was obvious that he'd visited you instead of coming to Captain Picard's dinner, but he won't discuss what happened. Whatever it was upset him," the green-haired duelist went on, his tone speculative. "That much was obvious, but he won't talk about it."
The blonde blinked, amazed. Then she smothered it under another layer of resignation. Reaching into her pocket, she handed him a much wrinkled piece of paper. "Read it," she said, and turned away. "What the hell? Everybody will know soon enough." Sionji straightened the paper, which seemed to have been crumpled and smoothed several times, and read it silently. When he'd finished, he lowered it and said, without a trace of irony, "That's a remarkable gift. Congratulations." Liza, who had been staring out the front of the car, whirled, her face angry.
"Congratulations?" she blurted. "Congratulations for being a genetic aberrant? Congratulations for bringing shame on my family? Congratulations for destroying the Institute?"
"Congratulations," Sionji replied imperturbably, "for having such a power."
"Oh, fine," said Liza. "My life is ruined, my parents won't speak to me, and everyone I know hates me, but I have a power, so everything's okay."
"Has it occurred to you," Sionji wondered, "that perhaps you're better off with parents who refuse to speak to you?"
"It's crossed my mind. But without them, what am I supposed to do? I have nothing. Nothing! I can't even afford to have these lousy clothes washed. I am nothing. I'm 16 years old and my life is over."
Despite himself, Sionji smiled. "You remind me of someone I once knew," he said. "She was younger than you are, and possibly more troubled, if you can imagine it. But the source of her troubles was just the same. Her family." Despite herself, Liza looked interested. "What happened to her?"
"She had a very rude awakening one day," said Sionji. "A day when nothing really changed, but she saw the world in a different light, and so everything changed for her. I don't know what finally became of her. Either she got better, or she went completely mad."
He held up the crumpled sheet of paper and pointed to the last paragraph. "I wouldn't like to see that happen to you." Liza laughed bitterly.
"Then you are alone among your peers," she retorted.
"In many ways," Sionji replied with dry sardony, "but not in this. Why do you think Skyeth sought you out? Why am I bothering to talk to you instead of leaving you to your fate or helping you find a way to open those doors? Why, for that matter, didn't Kate just leave you to the tender mercies of the Corps?"
"Caitlin,
Liza's jaw quivered. She swallowed, shook her head, and said in a shaky voice, "Caitlin is a good person. She wouldn't leave anyone in that position. Not even her worst enemy. No matter how much she deserved it." Sionji didn't seem very sympathetic. "Been there," he said. "Done that. I tried to kill Caitlin the first time I met her. I was trying to kill Tenjo that day, too. I've tried to kill her several times, in fact." He fixed her with an intent gaze from his pale violet eyes, and she found herself uneasy, almost afraid of him, but unable to look away, as he continued. "I know what it is to be driven mad by circumstance, by failure, by one's own weaknesses. You've been twisted into what you are by the inhuman pressures of your family. I was twisted into what I was by the callous manipulation of my best friend. I got over it. You can, too." "Easy for you to say," Liza snapped. "No," said Sionji. "It isn't." "How did you get over it, then?" asked Liza sarcastically. "Did you find God?" "No," said Sionji. "I looked the devil himself in the eye. I walked a desert alone with my madness for a week, then fell into a land of ice and snow. I was humbled by a girl with a quiet rage, and healed by the kindness of an alien stranger." He cracked another small smile. "I'm not recommending my exact method." Liza snorted, but the sound was covering something else. She turned away before he could see the tears filling her eyes, or so she thought. Her voice was slightly muffled by her hand over her mouth as she said, "Why would anyone want to be my friend?" "I don't know," Sionji replied bluntly. "I haven't seen any of your good qualities, if you have any. Every time I've spoken to you, except this one, you've been cruel, vindictive, and petty. You've also shown yourself to be a manipulative coward and a poor loser." Liza turned back to face him, wiping at her eyes, and gave him a wan grin. "Well," she said with a weak chuckle, "at least you're honest." "But for all that, you have a great gift," Sionji persisted. "What remains to be seen is whether you have the will to use it." Then, with an abruptness that shocked Liza Broadbank to her very core, Sionji drew his sword, reversed it, and stabbed himself. He didn't make a sound, but Liza made it for him, screaming in sudden terror as the blood flowed down the blade and dripped onto the shuttle car's carpet. The blade slid out and fell to the floor. He fell to his knees, bleeding profusely from the wound in his side, then toppled and sprawled. "Oh my God!" Liza cried, rushing to his side. "What the hell did you do that for?" she demanded, but he was all but insensate with pain and didn't hear her. She looked around for the car's intercom panel, but in her panic everything was a blur. She couldn't find it. Operating on sheer instinct, she sank to her knees next to him, unmindful of the hot stickiness of the growing pool of blood, and tore his shirt away from the wound. It was a clean cut, deep into the right side of his abdomen, and there was so much blood that she couldn't see how bad it was. She wasn't sure she would have known that anyway, not being much of an anatomist. Sionji was already pale, sweat standing out on his lean face. Liza made horrified little noises, looked around again for the comm, failed to find it again. Her mind raced. What did he do that for? Stupid, stupid man, what was he trying to prove? Even if I am an anodyne, I don't know how to use it. I don't have any idea what to do. Oh my God, he's going to die. He's going to die because of me, because of something I said. I've killed one of Kate's friends. Even if she could forgive me for everything else, she'll never forgive me for this. What am I going to do? Enough, she told herself, and seized hold of herself with both metaphorical hands. Her real hands clenched into fists, her nails drawing blood from her palms. Enough! Panic isn't going to help. He's dying. You're supposed to be some kind of healer. Heal him. Completely uncertain of what she should do, Liza reached out with trembling hands and touched him, putting her hands to either side of the wound. Is it bleeding more slowly now? Don't think about that. You'll just panic again.
Concentrate. I know you don't know what to do, but concentrate. The pain slammed into her like a hammer. She wobbled on her knees, nearly pitching forward over him, and only steadied herself with a supreme act of will, biting her lip until it, too, bled. It was as though her own side were on fire, as though she could feel his life slipping away. No, she thought, and grabbed at it with her thoughts. Darkness crowded around. She pushed it back. A dull heat seemed to build in her hands, as if she were holding them up to a roaring fireplace. The horrible pain in her side eased, replaced by a stabbing discomfort in her temples. Liza squeezed her eyes shut, forced it out of her mind, and concentrated on that heat, building it, pushing it out. Just like that, it was over. Exhausted, she fell back into a sloppy approximation of César, her bloody hands falling slack at her sides. She blinked sweat out of her eyes and looked. Sayanji murmured, stirred, and sat up, prodding experimentally at the place in his side where, a moment before, he had been, perhaps, mortally wounded. Well, he said dryly, that's one question answered. Liza slapped him as hard as she could, which wasn't really all that hard, given that she felt like a wrung-out towel. What the hell was that supposed to be? She demanded. If I'd cut my hand, he replied, you might not have taken it as all that urgent. You could have killed yourself! Perhaps. Sionji picked up his sword, wiped it on his ruined shirt, and put it away. I hadn't actually intended to wound myself quite that badly, but you have a way of making me angry, he said with a little smile. You stabbed yourself in the gut just to see if it would motivate me to use my power? Basically. You're out of your goddamn mind, Liza declared. That accusation has been made before, he agreed. He got to his feet, stretched his newly repaired side experimentally, then held out a hand to help Liza up. I hope we don't run into anyone from security looking like this, he added. Liza looked him over, shirt torn, covered in blood, then glanced down at her own bloodied hands and legs. She couldn't help it. She laughed. So did Sionji. The large quantity of blood in the shuttle car caused considerable furor in security when it was discovered the following morning, but no one could be found who was injured, and in the end the mystery was abandoned. Almost immediately, a completely apocryphal tale of a wounded construction worker who bled to death in that car while being rushed to Medlab, and whose ghost now haunted the car and covered it in spectral blood at irregular intervals, entered the station's collective cultural background noise.